Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks talking. Yeah, that helps a lot. Welcome to Geeks On, a show created by geeks for geeks, covering covering topics that geeks like to talk about. This week, it's Geeks On RPG openings and CES. For all the news and anything we talk about on the show, visit our website at www.geeksan.com.
Hello, my geeklings!
It's an errandless beginning. To Geeks On.
Aaron free.
Now with 100% less Aaron.
Yes, you'll notice it's a little less...
less rage.
Yeah, you notice it's a little it's a little less cynical in the room.
It's brighter in here.
The world is a sunny place.
Yeah, Aaron's out at CES.
The Consumer Electronics Show, for those of you not in the know.
Yes, with Lisa Lasik. And they
Lisa Lasik.
They are looking at everything that is cool under the sun. They'll bring in...
They're watching TV in 3D right now.
I know.
It's not fair.
No, it's not. And actually, I saw some of the new stuff. Hopefully, they'll find the 3D TVs that don't use the goggles.
Yeah.
That stuff is unbelievable.
Are you
to
kidding
me?
They don't use goggles?
Yeah, they have some that don't use goggles.
I'm not sure how that works.
I have no idea how that would work.
I think it's actually a big empty box with a puppet show inside. costs a little extra for the illegal alien immigrants to sort of like hang out in your box and.
Avatar's a totally
wow. Where are you going?
Experience there, huh?
Yeah, Aaron actually, I'll read some of his Twitter feeds. He's got built-in Skype from your Panasonic TV. He's got this shot of everybody wearing 3D glasses. He's got Canon with a new line of tiny HD cams. He's got all of these amazing links. He's got this really cool remote camera that flies around the room. But you can check out his Twitter feed at geeksan.com, or you can check out Aaron's Twitter feed, which is Aaron. The O is in a zero rather than whatever, because he wants to make things difficult.
Wow.
Leet speak. It's Aaron and Leet speak.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Aaron's very leet.
Well, how was your geek week?
It was good.
It's been a busy geek week.
It's been a long week.
Not a lot of time to do my typical geekly stuff. You know, it's a new year. We're catching up. It's 2010.
Absolutely.
You know, you're doing all the spring cleaning, throwing out all your stuff, getting new stuff.
Well, we did a role-playing game, which we'll cover a little bit more in our topic.
It's been a long time since we've actually played a role-playing game together.
And I ran, and it didn't suck.
Yay!
Wow.
Even better, we actually scheduled the second time we were going to do it this time instead of like saying, oh, yeah, we'll schedule it later. So this one may actually continue.
It might happen.
It's impressive.
It might happen. Two in a row.
Well, and it's nice, too, because it's like we don't actually get to see Mira all that often, Matt's little one, Matt's spawn. So we actually get to role play with the child to the horror of Matt's wife.
Oh, yeah. We have a picture of her looking at all of my books, and there are a bunch of like 20-sided die on the table.
Oh, she's just lighting up looking at those dice.
That was actually right after Aaron rolled.
Yeah.
So she was watching Aaron roll.
Roll, yeah. And
so
he's holding her on her lap.
It's Mira's first roll.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is.
I showed the picture to Kat, and she went, no, honey, no. No, honey, no.
I actually have decided for Mira's birthday, I'm going to find this somehow. Maybe there's a handy geekling out there who can help me. I want to find or make a mobile that will hang above Mira's crib that consists of nothing but shiny and fuzzy dice of all different shapes and colors.
Oh, I see the horror.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I'm going to be the most hated uncle in Kat's mind.
It'll go in the closet. She'll bring it out when you show up.
That's fine. I'll just show up a lot more often. Oh, okay. I will linger for indefinite amounts of time in your living room.
By the way, Stephen Marinaccio, who is my and Aaron's brother. You guys met him?
No.
He does a lot of Halo games, stuff like that. He was James Cameron's project manager.
Oh, Long Beach guy?
Long Beach guy.
Yeah, I know him.
And he's optioned Eclipse Phase, which is a role-playing game, and started to turn it into a movie, and now they have their official movie website up. So EclipsePhaseMovie.com is now going.
Fun.
Cool. Check it out, because it's rather cool.
Well, shall we move on to a little geeks news?
Let's do it.
All right, so scientists in Italy have discovered a way of making artificial replacement bones out of wood.
Really?
Wood, yeah. They basically
George Washington would approve.
Yeah, they take the best wood that works, which is hilarious to me, is rattan.
Really?
Yeah. Not bamboo, not anything I would have predicted.
How weird.
They take rattan and they dip it in this substance and it stays there for a while. And it actually turns into a bone-like substance. The early trials on sheep that they've done, I guess sheep have bones that are similar to
ours. These have to be New Zealand scientists because only the New Zealanders are going to try and work that hard to get some wood into sheep.
I'm just going to leave it for a pause. Hang on. All right.
It's been a while since we've insulted the New Zealand segment of our audience.
Now I can move on. But basically,
I hear people in Australia cheering right now.
They break the legs of the sheep. They use the bone as a splint. And actually what they're seeing right now is that the bone is fully grafting on and after a while just disappears completely.
Oh, so it's not a bone replacement. It's an internal splint that grafts.
No, and eventually it will be a bone replacement. They're just seeing right now if they can graft it, you know, like a bone screw. Which they currently have. Like, I have titanium screws in my knee. Rather than using those right now, they could use actual bone. That would eventually become part of your own bone.
You're a cyborg, then. You're not actually...
I am a cyborg, yes.
I thought you were a bioreplicant.
I am a bioreplicant as well.
Okay. Or a necroreplicant?
Yeah,
is that what it is?
Because I have an allograft.
Yeah,
I have a dead guy's tendon in my knee.
Matt's made of dead people.
Yeah.
Matt's made of people. He's made of people.
But 5 years, they're saying we're going to be able to use this bone substance in hospitals. 5 years.
That's cool. Pretty nifty, actually.
That's pretty damn crazy. So there it is. Pete?
I'm going to try something. I'm going to try doing a roundup. But before I do that, I got a little bit of interesting stuff. Apparently, my father has solved the mystery of global warming.
Wow.
He called me this morning.
It's called Bino?
And it's 40 degrees in Florida. So apparently global warming doesn't exist because it's very cold in Florida right now in winter. He says, and he wants us to know that global warming is a conspiracy cooked up by kooks and communists to waste our money. So.
Okay.
Big
really?
News story.
Your dad?
My dad.
No.
He's one of those?
He's very, very right wing.
He's a Fox News watcher?
Oh, he loves Fox News.
I didn't know that. I'm sorry.
All right. So, here's the real roundup of news. Okay. Avatar is to be a trilogy. This comes from Ain't It Cool News. It just passed the $1 billion mark that makes it a success. It was always planned to be a trilogy. So, since it's a success, they will probably be
even though it's Pocahontas?
Yes.
It's not Pocahontas. It's Dances with Wolves.
No, it's Pocahontas.
Dances with Wolves.
Have you seen the guy? He does the plot of Pocahontas.
No.
And he literally replaces Jake Sully, J.S., with John Smith. And it's like he goes in and says he finds this princess. She's betrothed to, and we're talking the Disney movie of Pocahontas, right? You know, rather than getting information from Grandmother Willow, she gets it from the Tree of Souls or whatever it is. And then she's betrothed to someone within the tribe who wants to kill Jake Sully. And they're in Pocahontas, the Disney movie, they were mining gold. In this one, they're mining something else. It's crazy. I'll show you the sheet. It's unbelievable.
That is interesting.
How dead on it is.
I'm still sticking because the broader plot points click more with Dances with Wolves because, you know, he doesn't go home afterwards and they're not separated and they live happily ever after.
Right.
Well, spoiler!
There we go.
Whoops, that was a little late.
Yeah, let's edit that out, shall we?
Okay.
All right.
Apple, I don't want to deal with hate mail.
Apple and Google appear to be on a collision course for anyone who has not actually had their head out of the sand in a while.
Right.
So Google's Nexus One is going to be released to compete with the iPhone. And Apple has recently bought Quattro Wireless, which is a mobile advertising network. So they each seem to be taking over what the other does. Seems that the future...
Meanwhile, Microsoft's going, yeah, we'll let them fight it out and then beat up the winner.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. They seem to be getting kind of pushed around, you know, these days as well. So
I don't know. I still think of Microsoft as Pentax.
Pentax?
Storyteller joke. Never mind. World of Darkness.
75% of Japanese do their future... Let me do that again. 75% of Japanese do their social networking only from their phones. This comes from Future Lab. In Japan, 3G penetration is 95%. 85% of Japanese have a 3G plan, and they have a strong gaming aspect to their social networking. So we're over here, Facebook and Twitter are content exchange and organization. They have strong gaming elements over there that kind of...
That we don't have.
And they actually pay for their premium content. So the question is that going to be kind of the future for us? Which is
usually the way they work. I mean, usually the stuff that they're doing, we get in about 2 to 3 years. I mean, we're so far behind in the cell phone market. My friend Don Tai, he's a big star over in Thailand. He came over, 4 years ago, and I remember looking at his phone, and I was like, what is that? I mean, it was literally like, and he showed me, it was this tiny little thing. It had a camera, but it literally looked kind of like a packet of gum, and it had a camera on it, and you had one little like iPhone thing, and you rolled your way to the digits or to, you know, down this tiny little display on the side of it.
Like an old rotary phone?
Yeah. Well, no, like an iPod.
Yeah, an old rotary phone type thing.
You know? I don't want to die like that.
Yeah. No, but either. it was an amazing piece of equipment.
You just talking about how small it was.
It was just tiny. It was,
yeah,
it was,
I don't want
it was a
phone
pack
that
of gum.
Small. Like, I lose my iPhone enough as it is.
Right. Well, that's the thing. There's going to be a level at some point where it's going to be, we can't get any smaller.
We're already at a point where we shouldn't get any smaller for some of us.
Well, you like grandma. You like the big number phones and
have
stuff like that.
Have you seen the size of my hands? Can you honestly can you picture me trying to dial you on a pack of gum? Seriously. Seriously. I am not a 14-year-old girl. I need a man phone. You know?
There you go. There's your new company called Man
Phone. Man Phone.
So the internet creeps onto car dashboards.
Okay.
This sounds like a disaster waiting to happen. So yeah. High-tech companies like Intel and Google are putting 10-inch screens in the front seats to show HD video, 3D maps, and web pages. You can now surf the internet while you are driving. It does prevent you from watching videos when the car is moving, but you still have the internet.
Okay. No, yeah. Dumb. Silly.
However... They do have a warning when you start the car that says, please only use the online services when traffic conditions allow you to do so safely. So, I mean, clearly people
Well, I've always
to
wanted
this.
The map screen that sort of appeared over to the right, you know, like it's sort of clear through the but it appeared on my windshield.
Well, you know, CES actually has a computer with a clear screen that you can look through. Did you see that?
I mean, that's the thing that I'm waiting for, because then if I could project my map up on my, so I don't have to look down in my lap, you know, as I'm, or pull over to the side if I'm lost.
Well, you know, did you see that Google's phone is going to have a map service that it actually, you know how they've been, you know, in Google Maps, you can actually see what everything looks like.
Right.
Well, they actually have a service where it shows you a picture of the street where you're supposed to turn and what it looks like as you're coming up on it.
Hmm.
That's pretty
cool.
Handy.
Yeah.
What you got, Donnie?
Wait, I got one more.
Okay.
So Taser's new weapon, mobile phone monitoring. They have a new service that they're doing called Mobile Protector, and it allows parents to screen a child's incoming and outgoing calls and messages and block numbers and even listen in on conversations from their own phone.
You too can be Big Brother.
Yep. The child will know when the parent's listening in, but it will allow the basically what will happen is, say your kid gets a call. And it's a number that they've never been called from before. It'll notify you, and you can look at the number, and you can decide if you're going to allow, don't allow, or always allow from your phone. The really fun part, though, is that if the kid's pissing you off, you're at, you know, say, dinner, and mm-hmm. there's text messages coming through, and he's not listening to you, and he's answering his text messages, or he's getting calls, you can say, turn that phone off. And if they don't, you can just pick your phone up and go, okay, I'm turning your phone off for 1 hour, and just do it from your own phone.
I actually wholeheartedly approve of that.
I do.
Yeah.
And you can ground
them. As long
them.
As they can still reach 911 during that time period,
you can't.
In case you're beating the crap out of them.
You can't. They can. Yeah.
I just read some really horrific child abuse cases recently.
But wow. You know, just imagine, you're grounded for 2 days, no cell phone, and you just hit your phone button and it's gone.
It's gone
have
for 2 days.
Still have the phone for emergencies, but, mm-hmm. you know. So. All right, that's
till some little 13-year-old finds the hack.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I approve.
Yeah. What you got?
Okay, so this is sort of an interesting, if somewhat strange article. Basically, new research published in the December Journal of Personality and Social Psychology suggests that the stereotype of computer scientists as unwashed nerds may be partially responsible for the lack of women in the field, as shown by the National Science Foundation statistics.
Really?
So basically what they did was they set up this study of women trying to sort of decide what their major was. Actually, women and men, right?
Right.
And they set up two different rooms for them to sort of hang out for a little while in. One, they were told, was the waiting room for computer science majors, right? And basically they decked it out as a Star Trek enthusiast room. They had Star Trek paraphernalia on the walls, action figures, and all sort of geeky stuff all over the place. The other, they set up in sort of a conventional conservative plants, art, you know, art posters on the wall, that sort of thing. And what they found was that in women, the women who were left alone in the geeky environment, their interest in computer science has plummeted. Whereas the women who left were left in the standard conservative room kind of stayed the same.
What about the guys?
No change at all in men, depending on which room they were in. So what they're saying is sort of the examples of, like, you know, when you go into sort of a geeky dorm room, and let's face it, a lot of us engineering and scientific types tend to lean towards the geeky side, and we have that sort of paraphernalia around our rooms. It's driving away women from the fields because they don't want to be associated with that stereotype, according to this study.
Huh. So what would you put up to attract them?
Hello Kitty posters? I have no idea.
Well, let's just think about our wives.
Right.
And what how they react when they see things that we do that are geeky.
Right.
Occasionally they do walk in and go, honey, God, no.
Yeah.
No,
true.
Please.
True.
Like, I noticed Matt doesn't have his fuzzy dice hanging from his rearview mirror anymore.
That's because they snapped.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They're actually still in the car.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. I'm actually now using them as a lumbar support.
Okay. I kind of love that. That's cool.
Oh.
Do you still have the necklace with the D20 I gave you?
I do somewhere.
Yeah.
I just don't wear it.
Well, you're not a jewelry guy.
No.
But I thought you had to have that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on.
That's it. I just thought that was an interesting side point. I don't know how to make it. I think there's probably a lot more factors involved than they're taking into account here. But,
All right. So a Taiwanese man has been named the first person to successfully complete World of Warcraft. Collecting
really?
The game's staggering 986 achievements to effectively do everything there is to do in the hugely successful MMO. This is literally the most amazing news of the day. Little Gray beat the game after killing 390,895 creatures, administering 7,255,538,878 points of damage, completing 5,906 quests, averaging 14 quests a day, raiding 405 dungeons, and hugging 11 players. He only hugged 11 people in all that time. That's all I got to say.
That's so sad.
Yeah, he's even a geek in World of Warcraft. I believe we can safely add another statistic to the numbers. And he has had sex 0 times during this period.
I hope that's from the article.
Yeah, there are a bunch of people who are trying to downplay his achievement, saying, you know, he's not as cool as they are because they spent more time developing their characters. But let's give the guy a
How
break.
How do you spend more time developing your character in World of Warcraft? There is no like role playing achievements in there.
I'm not taking down the guy's achievement. I'm just saying, you know, let's cut the guy a break.
I'm saying, you know, I'd be sort of horrified if that were me. But yeah. You know, if more power to him, you know.
Yeah.
Awesome.
They're saying, you know, one of the other claims is that he received one event-tied achievement due to a glitch and didn't win it fairly. But, you know, who the hell cares? The guy, he's a huge geek.
He's the first person in the world to this achievement.
To complete World of Warcraft.
In the world.
Yes. Of Warcraft.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any more?
Pete,
does
you
say
were
if
close,
he was
though,
Horde?
Right?
Does he say what if he was Horde or Alliance? And what
no.
class and race? And
no, he's his character's name was Little Gray. That's all I know.
Hmm.
I wonder what the final thing he did was. Whether or not it was some climactic thing, or it was like,
or whether or not
probably
he was just
kill
like,
a bunny somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Just like
I just have to kill one more thing. That's one thing I actually did admire about World of Warcraft. Like, a lot of the MMORPGs I played before World of Warcraft, it's like, you're a first level character. Congratulations. Here's a club. Go outside the city gates. Kill a worm. oh, look, the worm killed you. Try again. You know, right. World of Warcraft is like, you're killing wolves. You know, it's, yeah, sure, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency would not approve, but at least they're somewhat dangerous. You know,
right.
I'm not hunting bunnies.
Right. Although I'll,
looking at you,
I
Final
wanted,
Fantasy XI.
I always wanted the wolves at one point to get ticked off, form into an actual pack, and use, like, tactics to take me down.
That would probably be another iteration of the MMORPG somewhere in the future.
See, the problem, though, is that you can't really use... There's only a certain level of tactics you can use in World of Warcraft, because it's not like you can hide behind a tree or...
Right.
You know, I mean...
Eventually. We'll see with Knights of the Old Republic.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with
that. I am fascinated. I just saw some new screenshots from that, and it looks unbelievable. Pete, you got anything else?
I'm done.
All right, I got one last little follow-up, unless you got something now.
I was just going to do a quick mini-review of the latest geeky show that I dipped my toes into over the break. The Vampire Diaries.
Oh, I know where you're going. Go ahead.
You do?
Yeah.
Really?
I read your tweets.
Okay, because now I've been watching Heroes, okay? I've been watching Heroes because it was the best example of bad TV making, as far as I was concerned.
Right.
What not to do with character development, what not to do with your storylines.
One good storyline, basically, as far as I see it.
Yeah, oh, actually, and now in the newest season, I actually have been more impressed with the writing, but frankly, the good writing is coming too late. They're now in season 4 or 5, whatever it is, finally investing into their characters and trying to develop their characters a little bit. But it's so late in the game, you don't care anymore.
Right.
These are people that have been so long with so much momentum behind them that it's hard to give a crap about them now.
Right.
But that said, they introduced one new character who I have a feeling nobody else in the world but me will enjoy. A deaf cellist that has the ability to see sound.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, like all the writers in the room go, oh, that's interesting and touching. Mm-hmm. And how absolutely inappropriate for a show like Heroes. You
right.
know? Anyway, I've been watching Heroes as sort of a lesson in what not to do. Now I think that Vampire Diaries may be replacing Heroes and finally allowing me to put that show to rest.
As your new benchmark of bad?
As my new benchmark of horror.
Wow.
I mean, this show is a wreck. I was horrified by the... I mean, the first episode actually had me laughing out loud.
What, is it on? What...
It is on CW.
CW?
Yeah, and okay. It's the epitome of what I sort of expected from CW.
The 90210-ish vampire?
Vapid little characters with no real significant brain power or actual personality. Just, they're sort of banking on these actors' looks to sell the characters. There are no unattractive characters in the town of any age. Like, even like the 80-year-old math teacher is sort of hunky, you know, it's sort of weird.
Okay.
But it has all the flaws of Twilight sort of taken to the nth degree. You're supposed to believe that these characters have this unbelievable chemistry with each other, despite the fact that they have actually very little personality. Like, there's no personality to hang these attractions on.
Okay.
The lead character, this woman, is supposed to be very special, and like all the vampires in town are falling in love with her, the two brothers, and you're not really sure why. Like, she... You know, spoiler alert, looks like the woman who sired both of them.
Okay.
I'm not sure why that means they're attracted to her, you know, and they're like 8 episodes in now, and I still don't know why.
Well, when I saw you talking about it, you were saying the second episode you actually couldn't physically watch.
I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to after how bad the pilot was.
Okay.
Yeah, the pilot was...
Are you just trying to drive through as far as you can?
I drove through. I forced myself to sit through every episode that was on my DVR.
Why? That's what I want to know. Why?
Okay, I learned something from watching this.
Yes.
I learned a new type of television writing. I actually did. And this is... I'm not going to say I want to engage in this type of television writing, but I've never seen it before, though I think it exists in daytime television. What I'm calling this new type of television is called affirmation television. What this show does is it drops really, really blatant hints as to what plot points may be coming up. Mm-hmm. It's not foreshadowing. It's for shading. It's for sketching.
Forgiving.
It's for giving. Yeah. but they don't say outright, this guy is going to kill this one. They just tell you in every other way possible. So the audience member goes, oh, I think they're going to kill this person because every indicator in the world exists spelling it out for you. Mm-hmm. So when that guy gets killed in exactly the way you predicted, you're supposed to feel good because you saw that plot point coming. It's sort of like in movie theaters.
So it's like kiddie mysteries?
It's like kiddie mysteries. It's like when you see those in front of movies, they have the little factoids beforehand.
Right.
Like, in what movie does Matt Damon play a white South African soccer star?
Yeah. Right.
Like, everyone knows. Like, mm-hmm. no, but you're supposed to feel good about yourself for knowing when they reveal it.
And they show
it.
You a picture of, yeah. of him in the movie.
Vampire Diaries is an hour-long version of that. You're supposed to feel good because you see everything coming three episodes before. There are no surprises, and
that's why Smallville has gotten, and I feel
is
like,
Smallville an affirmation show?
Oh god, yeah. When okay. it's not an advertisement for whatever they're deciding that they need to pimp out this week, the
there's
Verizon
a lot of pimping
or,
going on in this, and maybe that's a CW thing.
Like it drives me nuts at this point. I mean, because I feel like I'm waiting for, like, one plot line to pay off, and then I can leave. Like, he finally admits, I'm Superman, or he comes up with the name, or he decides he's in love with Lois. Whatever the big, you know, one of the cornerstones of Superman is. And then I can just finally get out. But they won't give it to me. So, it's just like this ongoing nail to the face.
Well, so, it's clearly being... Vampire Diaries is clearly being made as a bid for the Twilight audience... if you're a diehard Twilight fan, give it a shot, because clearly you don't demand that much from your storylines anyway.
No! we're trying to build up our listenership. If you offend the 12 and 13-year-old girls who actually go out and are into this technology, what are we doing?
I'm an old Anne Ricer, you know, and I'm basically shouting at these Twilight folks to get off my lawn. I'll admit that.
Wow.
But this is not where I saw the vampire genre going when I was younger. It's vampire light.
Okay.
I thought we were going to have like a less hatred episode. Or
no, no,
less
no.
Less bitterness.
This is what happens vitriol. When you roll me out
just,
of bed.
Just different hatred.
Different hatred. Okay.
So I covered something called the Antikythera mechanism. It had been discovered on an ancient Greek ship. And pulled up from underneath the ocean. This was a few months back. They've basically used x-rays and advanced photography techniques to finally figure out what this thing does. And effectively what they're saying is that this device found in 150 BC or created in 150 BC was 1,500 years ahead of its time. They found this thing in 1900, this original wreck. They found this sort of piece of metal on this wreck, and they basically handed over to the Greek government this sort of corroded lump. When the lump fell apart, a bunch of gears popped out, and they were like, huh, what's going on with that? Now, through the use of our photographic techniques and the fact that we can throw different bands and spectrums of light on it, they've been able to read the Greek that was actually written on it and find out what it was all about. This guy first suggested that it was built on the metonic cycle, which is a 235-month pattern commonly used to predict eclipses in the ancient world. Now, the thing that's amazing, because they've now done 3D models of it, was that devices with this level of complexity were not seen again for almost 1,500 years, and the Antikythera mechanism's compactness actually bests the later designs. Probably built around 150 BC, the Antikythera mechanism can perform a number of functions just by turning a crank on the side. Using nothing but an ingenious system of gears, the mechanism could be used to predict the month, day, and hour of an eclipse, and even accounted for leap years. It could also predict the position of the sun and moon against the zodiac, and has a gear train that turns a black and white stone to show the moon's phase on a given date. It could also show the astronomical positions of the planets known to the ancients: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The Antikythera mechanism wasn't just a scientific tool; it also had a social purpose. It predicted when and told when the Olympics were.
Or the end of the world.
Yeah, I was about to say.
There we go.
I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah.
Did it stop working in 2012?
Yeah.
Did it actually manage to predict John Cusack?
Maybe. The true genius of the mechanism goes beyond even the complex calculations and craftsmanship of a mechanical calendar. For example, the ancients didn't know that the moon has an elliptical orbit, so they didn't know why it sometimes slowed or sped up as it moved through the zodiac. The mechanism's creator used epicyclic gears, also known as planetary gears, with a pin and slot mechanism that mimicked this apparent shifting in the moon's movement. This use of epicyclic gears is far ahead what anybody suspected ancient technology was capable of.
Hmm.
So, I mean, and basically what they're attributing this back to was Archimedes' workshop, is that basically he had a set of designs and that his students and stuff like that on Corinth or in Sicily were continuing to make his designs. But if that's the case, they don't know why they haven't found any more of these.
Well, it makes you wonder if there was some genius that was on the ship that went down with the device.
Yeah, exactly.
Which would be,
or maybe the
so
rest
sad.
Of them were they destroyed? Were they destroyed in the Library of Alexandria when Alexandria went up? You know, I mean, this the fact that this is 1,500 years ahead of its time. I mean, it's the equivalent of finding a fully functional Buick in medieval Europe. I mean,
my suspicion would be, a purge of knowledge, not the destruction of the Library of Alexandria. How do you destroy all of a mechanism
right.
in a single location? I don't see that happening.
The
fire burned down the library and
yeah, but not all mechanisms are going to be stored in the library that
right.
way. You know, books, yes, but not mechanisms. So that sort of thing would most likely be dispersed. But a coordinated purge of knowledge, as occurred during the Dark Ages, that wouldn't surprise me.
It's a conspiracy.
It is a conspiracy.
Always is.
Right. I don't know. There's a good movie here somewhere.
Shall we move on to our geek topic?
I think we should.
All right.
Let's do it. So let me say what my intention was in this game. This is all about beginning RPG games in a quick and efficient way, and perhaps other cheats and ways to cheat time in role-playing games, so you're not just sort of eating up time with nonsense.
Well, let's start by saying, like, when you typically play a role-playing game, the first thing you do is you create your characters.
Yeah.
And there are some systems where creating a character can be relatively quick.
Yes.
Right.
There are some systems where taking a character will be your first session.
Exactly.
Right.
You can
spend a couple of hours doing it.
Yeah. And Palladium, which is literally the first offshoot, I believe, of role-playing games after D&D, where they were trying to improve on the D&D system, and over the years it's just grown and grown and grown and grown and grown, is very clunky. And I can create a character relatively quickly, which means half an hour to 40 minutes, and I know everything about it. Trying to create characters for a group of people who are unfamiliar with the system is a day's worth of work. So when we don't have the amount of time to play, for me, I was just like, how do I make this quicker? So what I did with this this role-playing game was I basically decided that the entire first few adventures were going to be about achieving a skill list. And so I said, all right, here are the characters that you guys are playing. In this case, they're playing into a sort of a boot camp scenario. They're all going to be soldiers. They all had a basic skill packet they were going to pick up in boot camp. But there's a set of secondary skills that come along with the Rift's characters. And I basically said, all right, your secondary skills are your ability to change the plot and tell me how you got this skill. So we would do sort of a lost flashback in the moment, and whoever the character was at that moment who decided, you know, I really need to sneak out of the house right now, they decided to tell me how they got that sneaking skill and how good they were and stuff like that.
To put that another way,
mm-hmm.
you decided that you were going to make the character creation part of the role-playing.
Exactly.
So that we would start our adventure, and we would kind of create our characters as we went along.
Right.
Right. And so there were a couple things you did. I mean, the first thing you did that was really interesting was you said, okay, we're going to roll our dice. We're going to just start off with our base stats. And you had us each pick a stat that we were going to have be the one that we thought was going to be our big stat.
Yeah.
I did think it was interesting that you went with 3d6, not 4d6 minus 1.
Right. Well, the tendency in Rifts is that you get so uber so quickly. I wanted to start the benchmark as low as possible. So, I mean, because in any game where somebody with a handgun can become a tank, you know, and all you have is a handgun. And okay, now you can take out a village worth of people. You know, it was like, let's start as low as possible. So, you know, I made some of you guys into trolls.
Yeah. One of the funny things was that, you know, you had us all roll 3d6 for every stat, but you had us pick one stat that if we rolled a one or a two, we could re-roll them.
Yeah.
The idea being that was going to be our big stat.
Right.
The funny thing was that almost throughout the whole thing, the stat we all picked and the character we were kind of angling towards.
Right.
We rolled...
Yeah, not
really
one of
poorly.
Us got that.
Not one of us got a high stat on that.
Exactly.
We're always in something else randomly.
Yeah, Aaron wanted a fighter. He ended up with a brainy dude.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You wanted a brainy dude. I think you end up with a sort of
he's
dwarfish
a moose,
powerhouse.
You're the tank. Yeah.
So that was interesting. But that was all we did to start off with was roll that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the game actually started.
Yep.
And then you rolled for psionics.
Yep.
And did we roll for where we came from?
Yes. Basically I wanted to know what part, so you guys would have a grounding. I basically said, here's how the world formed and these are the main places that we're dealing with. This is your hometown. Go. Now you decided based on sort of a limited set of your hometown that it would be sort of copacetic role playing in terms of where your skill package came
from. And you said when we walked in, you said, I want us to be actually playing in 20 minutes.
Yes.
That's the goal of this.
That was the goal.
I think we were actually playing in about 17 and a half minutes.
Good.
I think we got
going. We came close.
Yeah. So that went really quickly.
Yeah, that was the thing, because how many times have we played Rifts, Don, or attempted to?
Yeah, and it's the first session is shot because you're making the characters.
Yeah.
Then you have to schedule the second one. The second one doesn't always happen.
No.
You know, just with our lives. So, this was refreshing.
Yeah.
You know, it was a good way to get going quickly. Matt did a good job of, and this is important for every game master, when you're trying to hit the ground running, you need to sort of establish the world that your players are in as quickly as possible.
Right.
Now, sometimes what that means, and Matt did this very nicely, is describing the scene as it is presented neutrally, and then addressing different players individually and coloring their perceptions of what you're seeing.
Right. Like, I would basically say you're coming into a gigantic hall. It's filled with thousands of seats. Various people are filling in. And on every seat is a skull. And then I would talk to Aaron's character, who is incredibly smart. And I would say, oh, you know what? The skull that's on the seat is actually a computer algorithm, and it's a helmet, and it's got all of these different wires coming out of it, and you can tell exactly what it does. Whereas I would talk to another one of our friend's character who is rather dumb, and I would be like, you have no idea what it is, and it's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Or my character was a guy who, you know, grew up on the streets, and you know, I'd look around and you'd tell me everybody looks extremely well fed and a little fat here. You know, it's like, you know, because I come from a place where everyone's starving.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and for someone who needs to establish a world quickly, that helps people key in very well to what's going on.
Yeah.
Now, you know, Peter understands, oh, okay, I'm surrounded by a world of plenty now. I'm not from this world.
Right.
You know, and it set a tone for Peter's character where, like, these are people I can fleece. You know, these are a soft herd to be culled and fed from. You know, it's...
And he played it really well.
Yeah, it was very nice. You know, and part of it, of course, is that, you know, his character was very self-confident and didn't necessarily have the faculties to do what he thought he could.
Right.
You know, but... And on top of that, Matt's painting a picture of a world that none of us actually know because none of us are that familiar with Rifts.
Right.
So, you know, describing those little sub-elements against the bigger backdrop of, you know, there's this massive building that everyone lives in. Everything outside that building is destroyed. You know, these little details help people key in quickly when you're playing with characters who are not familiar with that environment.
Okay.
Now, the second thing that you did, though, was you encouraged us to take a much stronger hand in the story.
Right.
And you did that. You did that by giving us two different things that we could do.
Right.
And you already talked about one of them.
Right.
But that was, you said you have seven different skills.
Mm-hmm.
And at any time during the game, you can tell me what one of these skills are that you had, but you have to stop and tell me how you gained that skill.
Right.
In your childhood.
Right.
Which was a lot of fun because instead of just sitting down and trying to figure out who our character was up front, we were finding our character. We had time to find them and make them nuanced and richer and develop them.
Right. That thought developed because in role-playing games, there's always a point where you level up, which is smart. I mean, we do learn new skills along the way. We do develop. But at a certain point, we've spent a certain part of our life going, you know what? I want to learn a martial art. And then we study for a while, we study for a while, we study for a while, and then we achieve that skill. So for me, it's not suddenly second level, bloop, I can do kung fu.
I know kung fu.
Right. Yeah. So I had wanted to basically say, every time you guys level up, now you have a new story point. And you can say, well, you know what? You know, I really need to sneak out of the house right now. I knew how to prowl from a very early age because, you know, my dad used to be, you know, a taskmaster, whatever it is.
Right.
And it allows me to fill out your character a little bit more and then utilize the details that you give me to fill out the world even more. So part of it allows sort of a copacetic storytelling it takes a little bit of the onus off of the game master when you want to create a game faster because you have, you know, a game created by six people. I'm also taking Don's note from when we last did our RPG session, which was the player characters are the main characters. And I know I'm sitting with a bunch of storytellers at the table and that you guys can tell just as good a story, if not better, than I can. So I sort of put the onus on you guys to help tell your story in an even better way.
That I stand by that statement. I think it worked out very nicely, in that trust your players to tell you where they want the story to go. They will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you've got a group. I mean, there is a type of role player called the Wallflower, who's just perfectly happy to just kind of exist and listen to what's going on,
right,
and then just sort of step in and take an action once in a while that supports something that someone else is doing and then go back to that position. Unless you happen to have an entire group made of those. I refer to them as the Daphnes in the Scooby. the Scooby setup, that's the Daphne.
Hey, Scoob.
Yeah. For those of you who aren't familiar with the Scooby setup, there is a theory that every successful role-playing group has one character akin to each of the characters from Scooby-Doo.
Hmm. Peter, what would you be? Velma, Daphne, Fred, Scooby.
I don't know. I got to think about that for a second. Who would you be?
Yeah.
Me? Yeah. I always play Fred.
Yeah, Matt's a Fred.
I always play Fred.
Matt's a total Fred. I'm a Velma.
What am I?
I would actually say that you're a Shaggy.
Shaggy?
Because you're a role player. You like to sort of do the character thing, mm-hmm, uh-huh, and sort of success be damed.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to do what the character would do.
And then you get into hijinks ensue. Yeah.
Right.
I want to be more of a Shaggy, but I keep slipping into my Velma. You know, it's hard for me not to do that. You know, and then like
Scooby-Doo role-playing game would be fantastic.
I would do it.
That could be fun.
Yeah. That would be just fun.
But it wouldn't have to be straightforward. It would have to be like the new Scooby. Like,
right,
you know, the Mark II Scooby, right, game.
Or even Scooby's Missing, and, you know.
Yeah. But there's some other things to get started. I was actually thinking about what you did with this, and I was actually thinking you could take it a step farther, where, you know, stats don't always come into play right up front.
Right.
They really don't. So what we could have done would roll our stats and then keep them in a pool. And as we start moving forward in the game, and we start going through the different training exercises, then, mm-hmm, you start going like, are you good at this or not? Okay, I'm not so good at the running one, so I'm going to take my lower stat and put it in speed.
Huh.
You know, okay, now you're in the training.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to move this into IQ. I'm good at this.
That was interesting, but I kind of liked having a base set of stats that gave me some backbone to work off of so that I wasn't kind of min-maxing, because the character, mm-hmm, wasn't the type of character I had wanted to play,
mm-hmm,
but became, I mean, I'm actually becoming kind of attached to my character and, mm-hmm, having a lot of fun with him to the extent that that when we were playing, for example, mm-hmm, and as we were talking about, Matt would give us contexts for different things. When we got to the tank training section,
right,
where everyone got to learn how to drive tanks. Well, everyone else in the group came from a place of some level of privilege where they had driven a vehicle before.
Right.
I came from the slums. So I'd probably never driven a vehicle before.
Yeah.
Which for me became fun because I was able to voluntarily say, you know, I'm not going to take the same level of skill these guys are.
Just doesn't make sense.
Because I wouldn't have that. So I actually held my character back, and it became fun for me to say, okay, my character hates tanks, and we role-played out this thing where the very first day when I'm trying to learn how to drive the tank.
He ran over the commandant's motorcycle.
Right. You know. So.
Yeah, I don't think either way is wrong. I really don't. But it depends on
but
what
I do see
you want
to
do.
No, that makes sense. But I was also saying there's something fun about not having complete control because it keeps you from min-maxing your character.
True. But by the same token, without that extra flexibility, it's difficult to actually make the character that you were planning on making or that you wanted to make. So, for example, you wanted to make the brain.
Right.
And you're very far from it.
I'm nowhere near that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, meanwhile, Aaron, who really wanted to break from the brainy characters he always plays.
Yes.
Got
playing
sat
the brain.
With the brainy character. Yes. You know, it's like, all right. You know, anyway.
Well, I'm just wondering now, at the point we're at, what other things that can make the game more expedient in terms of a lip sync time? Like, we have a few training sequences, you know, and they're basically Rocky training sequences. How to ellipse time, but also make, you know, invest the characters in those time
okay,
periods.
My suggestion, and I'm playing in a Game of Thrones game right now. That suffers from severe time lag problems.
Okay.
For those of you not familiar with the Game of Thrones system, they've basically come up with a combat system for conversation. Where, like, if you walk into a conversation and you've got a goal, I want to make this person do this, you can treat the entire conversation like a combat. There are verbal parries, verbal dodges, verbal attacks. It's actually more akin to verbal Aikido, what's going on in these things. The problem is that can make the conversations go from 30 seconds, which is all it would normally take, to upwards of 5 to 10 minutes.
Wow.
It can take a really long time.
So it's happening in almost real time.
Yeah, pretty much. It gets a little rough. Now, a tendency for a heavy role-playing group, as we tend to be, and a lot of other people tend to be, is to want to sort of have a conversation for everything.
Right.
Right? Like, I need
Everybody's got a goal.
I need to go requisition these rifles, so we're going to roleplay you requisitioning the rifles. It's really not necessary, you know? My suggestion to keep things moving is for the game master to stay on top of each conversation and immediately think, is this necessary for the story? Is this going to be entertaining for the group?
Right.
Right? Now, if the answer to either of those is no. Mm-hmm. If the answer to one of those is no, truncate it. Try and keep it short. Brief, brief, brief. Brevity is good. If the answer to both of those is no, skip it.
Right.
Just say, you requisition the rifle successfully. Roll. No, I'm sorry, they don't have those rifles available. Yes, they have the rifles available.
Right.
Just keep it short. The world will get richer for it. I know it's counterintuitive because you're thinking, well, I'm cutting out interactions with the world. I'm cutting out things you'll see, things you'll do. But if it's not actually going to contribute to the player's experience, it shouldn't be there.
Right.
Yeah, you have to think about what makes a good story.
Yeah.
You have to think about what makes an entertaining story, what invests you in a story. So if it's not something that's helping the character evolve as a character, if it's not something that pushes the plot forward in some way, or if it's not something that is just fucking fun to do, drop it. Find a way to get through it as quickly as possible.
Right.
Yeah. And fucking fun is fun.
Yeah.
You know, like, wait, huh, hold on.
Yeah. No, it's fine.
Yeah, I got that right. Okay. Now, there are games where requisitioning the rifle can be a very valid and important thing to include. The role-playing game Paranoia, for example.
I was just thinking of that.
Yeah. In Paranoia, for those of you not familiar with it, Paranoia, you're a bunch of people who live in an underground society run by the computer, and the computer is your friend, and happiness is mandatory. Unhappiness is treason against the computer and punishable by death, you know? So you exist in this massive bureaucracy where requisitioning the rifle could be an entire quest, an entire evening, where you have to try and deal with all this bureaucratic crap, and if you ever show any sort of frustration or unhappiness, the computer will shoot you in the head.
Right.
You know, that becomes entertaining.
Right.
That's fun to watch. It's advancing the world and the story.
I don't know if it was someone here who did this or someone else I know, but they played Paranoia and they actually created forms that people had to fill out.
That was Aaron. Aaron's game master for it. Created triplicate forms for
that you had to fill out in a certain amount of time. It was like you had to do it really quickly. It's like you have 5 minutes to fill this out in triplicate. If you don't, you will be shot.
Yeah, I love that. Bureaucracy, the role-playing game.
Oh.
Gotta love it.
Yeah.
I think I would just be so frustrated. I'd just spend the entire game like, you know, I'm happy, I'm really great, well, again, but I'd leave with my shoulders around my ears.
I mean, it's obviously not a game for everybody.
Right. So how would you speed things up in the World of Darkness, in Vampyre and stuff? Because that also has a pretty intensive character creation system.
Yeah, World of Darkness is another... basically, I didn't try and speed it up. Whenever I created a character with somebody... usually they would get a one-on-one role-playing session with me for about 2 hours.
Oh, okay. So separate day.
By the time we started playing, I had invested 10 hours in that game. 2 hours with each player, creating their stats, creating their origin. But for me, that was fun. Like,
right.
I enjoyed doing that, and I made sure that was the one time every player was guaranteed just to have the spotlight on them.
Right.
You know, and then when we walked into the role playing, each of them already had a 2 hour route and connection with that character, which encouraged role playing.
Right.
I found, you know, and keep in mind, when I ran a game, there were entire sessions where no dice were rolled. It was just people yelling at each other across the table trying to achieve their goals, you know, and that's not for everybody.
So now Vampyre has the same sort of verbal Aikido thing that the Game of Thrones thing has, but it's not as formalized.
Yeah.
Do you have any hints as towards non-formalization of the verbal Aikido of saying, okay, you know, well, in this moment, just this one, you're going to make one roll just to see whether or not you convince them.
Yes. That would be my suggestion in general.
Okay.
One way I think for game masters, now there's always a problem when you're doing social role playing where sometimes a non-social gamer will take a very social character. And, you know, when a 60-pound weakling is playing Conan the Barbarian, we don't think twice about them saying, you know, well, I swing my arm and I hit them very hard. Right. Roll the die. When someone with Asperger's is playing, a social dilettante trying to seduce her way to the top, it becomes very hard for a game master to always treat that character with, you know, separately from the player.
That's interesting. I never thought of that.
It can be very difficult because when the player, playing the social dilettante walks up and says, you know, I grab them by the crotch and start humping their leg, you know, this is not going to be a successful seduction role.
Right.
You know, it's hard to sometimes give the character the weight it deserves. So my suggestion to a game master in that situation is to stop, ask the player, what is your stat in this area, right? And then to remind yourself, okay, this person has a very high appearance and a very high charisma.
Right.
And then do one of two different things. Either coach the player gently, which I don't suggest, but it can kind of help the player sort of grasp social dynamics a little bit. I've actually seen players kind of gain a new understanding of the way people work from this. You know, basically teach them a little bit of empathy. Or this one's not a great solution either, adjust the world accordingly. You know, Paris Hilton is now grabbing this guy by the crotch and humping. Well, okay, Paris Hilton's a bad suggestion, a bad example.
I don't know. She's got money and she's kind of cute.
Yeah, but she would grab someone by the crotch and hump their legs.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But maybe even pull it off.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Chelsea Clinton is grabbing this guy by the crotch and humping his leg.
Wow. Does he know that she's engaged?
Well, I was going to say one of the Bush twins, but I could see that happening, too. Politics.
All right, come back to us.
What was I talking about?
All right, dry humping a leg, remember.
So adjust the world a little bit where... you know, this is strange and it's a little off-putting and the guy doesn't necessarily react the way the player is hoping they will, but they still achieve their goal. Don't force the roll. You know, there's no reason to constantly have them rolling. What I'm saying is have the world react to the stat rather than the behavior sometimes. And then as they drift closer and closer to behavior that would be appropriate to the situation, the reactions get better. So, you know, humping the leg may get you past the guard, but a smile and a couple words will not only get you past the guard, but get his ID off of him for the, you know, the key card that'll get you past the inner sanctum door.
Right. There's also a thing for the people who are not the actors out there who are playing role-playing games. Yeah. Is there a ways of being expedient? You can use a word, a phrase, hey soldier, whatever it is. And then you walk up and you say, now using my character's massive charisma and beauty, I seduce this person rather than you may get more points for actually role playing the actual words that they say. But if you know that isn't your forte, just, give us the Cliff's Notes.
Though it does reduce your character to the warrior equivalent of I take my sword and I hit them.
Right.
You know, which is, if you're playing a social character, in general, people want to feel a little bit more attached to the personality.
Right.
So not everyone feels comfortable with doing that.
Right.
Well,
but one thing I would suggest would be, like, if you're that character, right, if you're playing that character and you're not good at this sort of social interaction, talk to other players. You know, other players may help you sort of kind of get a grip on what might be appropriate. Don't ask them what to do, but ask them, like, could you have any suggestions here?
Right.
Well, I think also what helps one of the things that will help people who are playing get into it is if you as the DM kind of set a standard for them.
Right.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're comfortable being silly and you're comfortable just kind of the more expressive you are, the more expressive they're going to feel comfortable doing it. And also by kind of drawing them into it. By literally doing a little bit of role playing with them,
yes,
you know, it'll encourage them to do it as well. Or, you know, for example, when Matt was saying, you have to tell me the story of what you did.
Right.
Things that cause them to invest something that makes them more comfortable in doing it. They'll grow into their characters.
Right. Now, the other thing I gave – go ahead.
One last comment on that. Now, also, I don't want people to misinterpret what I said before as it being the game master's responsibility to sort of mold – a player into what the game master thinks that character should be.
That's the way I used to play.
That is a bad thing. That is a very bad thing.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is make the world react appropriately to the way the character reacts, but try and spin it in a positive direction if the character is playing to their strengths.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, someone's playing an upper class high society dilettante, but they're playing her sort of whorishly to get her goals, right? That's not the way that you think a high society dilettante should act, but that's the way the player is portraying them. So you have to keep in mind that's what the player wants to play. As the game master, you need to help facilitate that so the person can have fun playing the character they want to be and engaging in the escapism that they're seeking.
Right.
So you can't force your perceptions on what a high society dilettante should be because they might just be Paris Hilton. You know, they don't have to be Leona Helmsley every time, you know.
Wow.
Well, one of the things you can also do, by the way, is you can help your characters find their voice, which can be really important. So you can give them context to the world. You can say, for example, in the same way that Matt was saying, you look around and everybody looks extremely well fed.
Mm-hmm.
He can also talk about, you know, you look around and you hear people talking and, you know, they sound like they're coming off of the holovids. They sound like actors. They don't sound like real people to you.
Right.
They don't, and you can give words that you would use. You can give things like that.
Yeah. Well, I also was kind of contextual with things that we have going on today. Like the city that exists outside of this gigantic arcology is much like Israel in Gaza. You know, one part is very well off and is allied with the gigantic arcology, and the other one, you know, gets stormed by stormtroopers every other night. Right. So, you know, it happened that two of our players were both from Israel. So I was like, you know, you have, you know, you're not Americans, but you are Israelis and you do have honored status with America. So you should be aware that that's where you come from. And, you know, if you're looking for citizenship in America, well, then, you know, play it like you're a well-favored immigrant coming to America. And they did. And they played it in a rather interesting way.
Yeah.
I got a question.
One other quick suggestion on this one that also would be helpful for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, as a game master, you do have story elements you want to help to guide your players to.
Right.
That's normal, and that's fine. Your players may fight against it. They may be looking after their own paths. But there are a way to steer characters in the direction you want them to go. So, for example, in Matt's game right now, two of the characters are so ugly they have horror factors.
Yes.
Right? So... And it's not because they're scarred up or anything horrible. They just – they started with ridiculously low rolls.
Yep.
So what Matt has been doing very well is sort of portraying the way that, you know, as long as they have their helmets on, they're treated like everyone else. As soon as they come off, people are sort of repelled by them.
Right.
Now, one thing you can do – that sets up a complex in the character in a good role player, right? They're going to start playing like the world hates me. They're going to start withdrawing a little bit. Now, one way to steer – a character like that in the direction you want them to go is to present an option, like a character that isn't repelled by them, right? When, you know, because every character seeks social interaction, every player seeks social interaction. When they have the opportunity to interact, they're going to keep going back to that well, right? And that becomes an in to your storylines. And that doesn't just have to be like social stuff. It can be, you know, you're of a social class that isn't allowed to shop anywhere. So now there's a shopkeeper over there that's willing to do business with you on the down low. So if you're a thief, you've just found a fence who's willing to deal with you. That fence now becomes a gateway to whatever the game master wants to throw at you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's think of every minor goal, every minor connection that your players want to achieve becomes a gateway to your story. So just a thought.
So you did three things.
Yes.
In the story. The first one was you had us roll our stats.
Right.
The second one is you said you have seven things you can pick as we go along.
Right.
The third one was very interesting.
Third one is I'm worried nobody's used it yet.
Yes.
So I'm waiting for the nuclear option to drop specifically from Don. and what it did, because Don can drop the nuclear option like almost nobody I know. I gave everybody one story point. And one story point is basically equal to 500 to 700 experience points. For this one game, they can use this story point to... I used it as sort of an extra quarter in the arcade game because my characters are going to be able to die easily. So this is the way of saying, no, the laser doesn't hit me full in the chest. It blows off my arm. It basically changes the line of the story. They basically, you know, have their get out of jail free card. Nobody's used it yet. They can also use it to change, you know, no, we're not going to Manitoba. We're going to Florida. We'll see how that goes when it comes down the line. I haven't seen whether or not it's game imbalancing yet.
Well, it's also one of those things where we don't know the world well enough to use that point yet.
Right.
We don't know how to affect things for the better at this point.
We also haven't been in a place where it's one of those things you say, it's your get out of jail free card. You don't want to use it until you're in jail.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we haven't actually gotten ourselves in a situation where one of us was going to die yet.
Well, and also I've played in a lot of games where they have things like fate points, destiny points. Mm-hmm. You know, they call it different things all the time. Usually there's sort of a variance on the number you get. When you have that one point, you find people are very miserly with it. They will only use it in a life or death situation.
Right.
You know, so, you know, if there are two, then you find people get a little bit more liberal with it. So if you're considering using the destiny or fate point system for your players, keep that in mind. If you're giving one, it's going to be a parachute. It's going to be something that saves them when they get thrown out of an airplane in the middle, you know, with nothing attached to them. If you give them two, get ready for them to run amok with your story because they will spend one of them just to see what happens. You know, it will happen that way. Just
I originally was going to give four. I was originally going to three minor story points and one major story point. And I looked at that after I had had everything down and I went, no fucking way.
Well, for example, the Game of Thrones system. Right? Depending on the age of your character, you actually do get destiny points.
Okay.
And a older character is more established. They have more skills. They have more qualities and benefits. But they have fewer destiny points. Younger players aren't quite as competent as the older ones. But they've got destiny points at the yin-yang.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way you spend... There are specific set ways you spend destiny points in the Song of Fire and Ice storyteller system. Some of which are... You know, I am engaged in a conversation with you. This is my goal. I am spending a destiny point. We do not have to engage in this combat. I successfully convince you. There are other ones where you can burn the point and make a plot point happen. You know, and when you burn the point, it's gone forever. If you spend the point, it's a minor effect that occurs within that game and then you get it back the next time you
play. Nice.
You know, so it's there are lots of different ways to roll with it.
Good,
you know?
More good things happen to Luke than necessarily to Han.
Exactly, because Han's got more skills.
Right.
You know, Luke's good with a lightsaber, but what else has he got going? Right. He can fix a hydro converter, you know?
Right.
So I have a question for you guys. One thing I, you know, that I have a little bit of trouble with in role-playing is that is when you have a situation where you have to create something on the fly, and it's going to be like a combat on the fly. You haven't figured out what the stats are. You haven't figured out, you know, how hard it's going to be. Do you have any advice for how to kind of create something that's still a realistic play where you're not just kind of fudging the numbers as they roll to make it interesting? How do you do that?
For me, I always have 15 characters who are pre-rolled on hand.
Okay.
And then basically I can go, okay, we're in this situation and I've already said this is a very hefty guy who's really strong and da la 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 la. I have that.
Got it.
And I can use him and immediately put him in. So that's basically my way of, I just slightly get a little bit more prepared beforehand. Don might have something that's...
I actually, this is the one time I encourage game masters to really know their system and to be ready to pull characters out of the air.
Yeah.
I'm not a prep person like Matt. I don't have sheets with character stats laying around. I tend to think in terms of what is my goal as a game master in this situation? Mm-hmm. Is this supposed to entertain, urge the characters in a specific direction, or is this something where one of their characters may be coming to an end? So for that, I tend to think of chaff threat, where it's sort of easy characters. So know the character's skill levels, and just have, you can whip out, you don't have to fully generate, just know how much damage can they take, what are the chances of them hitting, how much damage do they do.
Right.
Threat characters, which means your characters will probably get out of this, but not unscratched. You know, and they're going to have to work for this victory. Mm. Or threat characters.
Right.
You know, threat characters means usually a named character.
Wait, what was the middle one called?
Challenge.
Challenge. Okay, yeah. So there's chaff.
Chaff, challenge, and threat.
Okay.
I mean, it's CCT. Just what I'm thinking. Yeah. And in a threat, it's often named characters, mm-hmm. bodyguards, you know, characters that are supposed to be a physical threat that... honestly, your character shouldn't have been tangling with to begin with.
Right, right.
You know, it's usually if they're smart, they can avoid threat characters.
Right. Well,
you know, threat characters are the obstacles that are supposed to be avoided or fought at the end of a story.
Well, right? I had initially, you know, just I thought it would be so fast of a challenge wall. You know, like a literally typical military challenge wall where you guys climb up to the top of the wall, try and beat the other team to the top.
Turned into the hardest challenge of the
turned
night.
Turned into the ridiculously, like, most hard challenge of the day. And, you know, I had a character who was sort of a bit of Don's nemesis. Mm-hmm. And I was just role-playing him as I thought he would. He was vindictive. He was annoying. And he happened to be on Don's team. But he really didn't like Don. So I played very simply that he did exactly what he should have. Mm-hmm. The only thing was when he actually went for Don, I rolled incredibly bad. And in the past, I might have fudged those rolls, but I went, you know what? What are the ramifications of what happens if this guy actually does fall off the wall and break his neck and die? And it's become a very interesting sideline.
It
right
actually
now.
Made for a great story, and it yeah. also it. It turned out pretty cool because he was an established character.
Right.
We actually knew about his background beforehand, which turned sort of the ramifications of his accidental death at someone's hands. It made the ramifications very clear
right.
and pre-established and not pulled out of someone's butt.
Right.
You know, it actually came together very nicely.
Yeah.
So as a storyteller, you really want to – as a DM, you want to or GM,
mm-hmm.
you want to work on being able to just kind of roll with the punches and go places that you're not expecting the story to go. Because
right, yeah.
that's often where some of the best stuff will happen.
Yeah. I mean, I had
leads to advice number one, know your world.
Yeah. I had some adventures a little bit down the line, but I was like, oh, okay, well, this is a great door into them. Let's just use the door that they made rather than the door that I kind of wanted to make a few right. weeks from now.
Right.
Yeah, I'm reminded of a game that we played with Matt many years ago now.
Oh God, no.
Where we were in a house with like a stone house. We were surrounded by like a portal opened up right in the middle of the woods, and I remember all the players looking at the portal, going like, "I'm not going through that."
Yeah, you nah,
no, no way. Nah. Like, there's a mysterious portal opening in the middle of the woods with no explanation.
Yeah.
I'm not going through that.
Yeah,
and then suddenly, like, there's green slime dripping from the trees, and
exactly.
The house is surrounded by pools of acid.
Yeah.
And we're like, no, we're really not going through that thing now. Something's trying to shove us through. And like, we refused. We absolutely wouldn't go through that portal. And I think we actually did figure out a way not to go through it.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
And that ended the game session that day.
Why? You know, it was like, I had to go home and rewrite the whole thing.
Players will walk through any door they open.
Right.
Without hesitation. Any door that opens mysteriously on its own will be avoided like the plague.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Players don't go towards the creepy music.
No.
They tend to walk away.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, we should head over to the CES portion of our Geekzone episode.
Absolutely. Aaron is over at the Consumer Electronics Show in sunny Las Vegas with the lovely Lisa Lasik. Let's see what they're into.
We have Aaron and Lisa here with their little CES wrap-up.
You make it sound so quaint. Their little wrap-up.
Yeah, their little wrap-up of a multi-billion dollar event.
So, you know, this is not a comprehensive report of CES.
Not by any means.
All you're going to say is 3D TVs. That's all you're going to say, right?
Pretty much.
But there's so many places to actually go get lots of details on all the specific gadgets. In Gadget, Geekology.
Right.
It's all over the internet.
Right, it's all over the internet. But we kind of wanted to talk about what we felt was like kind of a, you know, the overview of CES and some of the strange little things that maybe didn't make some of the news.
And what we got our hands on ourselves.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And then speaking of getting hands on things, then we get to talk about the Adult Expo, which also shares that out.
I actually went there for two hours.
No, you
did
not.
And yeah. I missed it.
2 hours.
Lisa. Yeah.
I was at CES.
Yeah, she had a...
She was busy.
A little bit innocent.
I thought you were going to say you went there for about 15 minutes.
She was at the Yaoi.
I went there for about seven and a half minutes. So anyways, so first of all, let's just start out. I would say, if you haven't got it from the internet, that this CES was obviously the CES of 3D.
3D explosion.
To the point where...
What did it look like, first of all, as you walk in?
Well, okay. CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, is the entire
Las Vegas
Convention Center.
The whole thing.
The whole thing, including... Even it's spilling out into hotels that are adjacent in their
They're covering it as well. So they're also like, they're like, use our ballroom.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Okay.
There's stuff outside.
Like, it's so huge that we walked for 3 days and didn't even come close to seeing everything.
Bigger than Comic-Con.
Bigger than E3, I would say.
Yeah, bigger than Comic-Con, bigger than E3 as far as like the show floor.
Okay.
For sure.
And it rivals E3 in terms of just the sheer display. I mean, there were screens from floor to ceiling. In fact, they had one there that was like your EA presentation. It was just a giant wraparound screen.
Yeah.
Where they're like, Aaron Hendricks did this and we need to copy him.
Pretty much.
Okay, cool.
But, I mean, so the 3D, okay, we all knew that we were going to see 3D there.
Right.
I was shocked that... All the major television manufacturers, I would say 50% of the booth of each one was about 3D, if not more. So
okay.
It wasn't like they showed off a set that was 3D.
Hey, we got this one Sanyo thing that blah.
No.
They had so much 3D, they had to break it down by category. There was like, here's 3D movies, here's 3D video games, here's 3D football, and here's, there was just,
Like there were different TVs for each of those?
No, they just had different things each one.
Okay.
So, the general technology that seemed to be going on was... There was some type of Blu-ray player that was 3D capable, and then some type of television that was 3D capable. That was the combo player that you really needed.
Okay, awesome.
Then it seemed to be active 3D, which means your glasses, it wasn't just a polarizing thing. Your glasses were actually needed to be synced to the device. So just like...
So they were plugged in?
So there were those LCDs that, you
that
know...
flutter glasses. No, in fact, if you saw Avatar...
Yeah.
Most of the theaters, like the new theaters right now, have... In fact, you can see this little weird sensor in the middle between your two glasses. That one, that actually synced up with a signal that was going on in the theater, and your eyeglasses are fluttering back and forth, back and forth.
Huh.
So it doesn't darken the image like polarized do, where it looks like you're watching through sunglasses.
Right.
But it also makes the glasses heavy.
Yeah, because there's batteries involved.
Okay. So we just get stronger necks. That's all it is. We evolve stronger necks.
You get a
but so they all have those things. But, and those all were TVs that are coming out this year and Blu-rays that are coming out this year, Blu-ray players, that is.
When are you getting yours, Eric?
I don't know. But
that sounds like March to me.
You start to say no, and then you stop yourself because you know yourself way too well.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
The big debate is, you know, the big debate is whether anybody wants to sit down and watch. Like on Thursday nights, is everybody going to sit down on the couch, put on their glasses, and watch for 5 hours? I
don't
doubt it.
Think so.
Especially those heavy glasses
right.
that they had. They were taxing.
Stronger necks.
Now, we did see DirecTV is coming out this year with a whole channel, 3D channel. And they were broadcasting there. So they actually had content already.
What are they going to show? I mean,
Discovery Channel is making making content.
Yeah.
ESPN's making content. They've got all sorts of movies.
$10,000 pyramid looks fantastic in 3D.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Wow. I saw a football game, like one of those DirecTV, like just pure HD TV signal coming through. And I have to say, that was one of the more impressive things to me was just the football because you felt like you were kind of there.
Really?
And it's something easy to adapt to for some reason, football, because it's, I don't know, it's only on one field. There's not a whole lot of...
That was one of the first things to go high def, too, wasn't it?
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sports, right. So here's some of the interesting, though, I think things that stood out as far as 3D.
Actually, I think that was porn that went 3D or high def.
No, actually...
Isn't porn the vanguard?
Porn was one of the last ones.
Was
it really?
Yeah, because there are some things you don't want to see in high definition, and that's skin.
Put the Vaseline back on the lens.
Right. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah. Now, I mean,
you
3D,
can only pluck
we did
so
see,
much.
We yeah. did see at the adult... the adult convention, there was a guy who had 3D porn movies there.
Oh, my God.
And?
It's coming right at me.
Yes.
It's coming right at me.
Okay.
It's coming right at me.
So some of the standout technologies as far as 3D goes, there were demos of technology, but none of these televisions are actually coming out this year and maybe never. But there is demos of technologies from almost every manufacturer of 3D televisions where you did not have to wear glasses. Now, we saw this 3 years ago with LG had one of them, but now everybody had one. The problem is that the resolution seemed to go down a lot. Like, you could kind of see this pattern on it.
Yeah, and
then
you have to stand in exactly the
dead
the right
center
spot.
Of the room. Like, you couldn't step 1 foot in either direction, and it just wouldn't work. So if you had, like, a sitting chair right in front of the TV, you could watch 3D movies without glasses. But obviously, that is technology that they're trying to, you know...
They'll figure it out.
They'll figure it out. And I think in maybe 2 years, we might have see some television where you don't wear glasses. And that might be something that I think people could get into way more.
Although, I don't quite understand how it works in terms of... It seems like that those 3D things, the 3D was behind, kind of. It didn't come
well,
like,
they
all
had some.
The way out at you.
Remember
like,
the coins that were falling out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
They did have some.
It seems to me like it would have to be... Something where, like one of those posters where as you move your head, you see two different images.
That's kind of how it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt like a stereoscopic image.
What's that?
Like a stereoscopic image.
Well, you know.
The ones where you do deep focus and
No.
We're talking about when you're walking along and there's one of those posters that if you stand here and you look at it, it
they're
looks
like ribbed.
This.
Oh, it's the hologram, right?
You move your head.
Not even
like the Spider-Man one. That where it was his black. It was his black suit, and it was also his red suit, and depending on which side
yes,
you
probably,
looked at.
Yes, exactly.
Probably.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not holographic. It's actually that kind of ribbed look where you're actually looking through slats. So one of your eyes looking through one slat, and your other eye is looking through another slat, and that's how you're getting the stereo.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's why I think there was resolution loss, is that you're kind of – it's sending us – it's trying to send a picture from one eye, and then you just shift – you know, a couple inches, and it's sending a different picture to another eye. So you're losing half the resolution, I'm sure, that way.
Huh.
But the other one, and this is a television that you will be able to buy, I think, maybe at the end of the year, was, I think it was Samsung. They had this television that you did not need to have a 3D Blu-ray player hooked up to. This thing on the fly converted 2D content into 3D straight out. Now,
so
they demoed
2D animation?
Well, okay, so they demoed two things.
Animation and a video game.
They put in, they had Gears of War in there,
okay,
which I think did not work.
No, but it was, it sort of worked.
It kind of worked. But then they put in Ice Age, which is a like a, you know, Pixar-ish, right. Pixar-ish type of movie.
Right, right.
And that goddamn movie, it was in total 3D. I could not, it was a 2D regular disc, Blu-ray.
They must use parallax and animation. Obviously, they can detect the edges better, but honestly, I don't know how they do it.
It looked 3D. Huh. Now, it looked like the Viewmaster 3D. Like, there was a little muskrat, like, holding an egg. And with some mountains in the background. So the mountains looked like it was further in the back. The muskrat was there. And then the egg was in the foreground. But the egg wasn't a sphere. It just was a cutout circle.
Oh, so it really felt like sort of like the Disney animation where they take we have our background. We're drawing our animation in the foreground. And then we have, you know, it's like whenever I used to watch Scooby-Doo, I always knew what was going to happen because I could always tell like the part of the wall that was going to break was discolored. Right.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like that. It's like the old Viewmaster where they're literally just cut out, you know, images and then made them 3D. But, I mean, come on. It was a 2D disc when they put it in there.
And tell them what they said when you asked them how it worked.
So Lisa and I were flabbergasted. No, a lot of the people around us were like, oh, cool. I can't believe they did that. We were shocked.
We were like, what?
We kept what? And so we're trying to quiz these guys, and they obviously had no clue what they're talking about. I said, I don't understand. How does this work? And he goes, it's Samsung magic.
Did
you burn him
idea.
At the stake?
It was very clear that this guy had no clue what was going on. He was a booth
dude. There are little elves inside.
So anyway, I think we should move away from 3D, but there was a lot.
So a lot of 3D, and you could see it on various different sites.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I will tell you, we looked at, what was like Batman Asylum, what was it?
Arkham Asylum
in 3D, and we were like playing it in 3D, and you realize anything with a lot of shifting backgrounds.
That's going to make you vomit.
Exactly. Because, you know, it makes people vomit now in 2D. So that was
it shouldn't. We're in 3D. We can shift around.
I know. But something about video games, you know, especially that third person, just like the backgrounds whizzing.
I find it more on first
movies
person.
Movies don't use that camera whip as often as
unless you're playing. Unless you're watching The Bourne Identity.
Avatar did some of that.
Yeah, and I personally know a fair number of people who are
I know someone who threw up afterwards.
Yeah. One of the things that they talked, I just saw James Cameron speak an hour ago, and one of the things he was talking about is he said that what you tend to find with 3D is that you have to make one shot do the job of three shots, because all that editing and cutting actually is too much for your eye to handle.
We got to slow down. Shucks.
Yeah, it's like you can't cut between close-ups and a long shot without your eyes going kooky.
Yeah, because you don't do that in real life.
Right. Your eyes shift to a long shot. You don't cut to a long shot in real life, so your eyes get tired that way.
If you do too much of it,
yeah.
All right. We'll see.
Well, moving on. What did you guys find that was fascinating, interesting, and you loved?
One thing I like to talk about that was also a lot there when I first walked in was a lot of attention to media streaming and media, getting media throughout the house that you are, the content you already own to your television.
Now,
or
this is the adult forum or the CES?
What's that?
This is the adult forum or the CES?
Actually, both.
Oh, really?
Yeah, both. But so there is one thing I saw called the wireless media stick. If you go to HSTI.com.
Yeah, both Matt and I just
said stick. Yeah, sorry.
Anyway, it's a little USB device, and you like plop it on your TV, and it has software. It searches wirelessly all your network and finds any music, any movies, anything that's connected to it, and you can just watch it right there on your TV.
Dude.
That's it. One plug in and some software on your PC. I saw it run. It was pretty amazing. Like, if you just had stuff in iTunes, it would find it, and you could just play it.
And you don't have to worry about Apple DRM or any of that?
Well, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
But Apple doesn't have DRM anymore.
But on their movies, don't they?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I'm sure. And then I also saw Boxy. Now, I don't know if any of you guys know what Boxy is.
From Buck Rogers?
Boxy was from Battlestar.
Galactica. Right. Sorry.
Boxy is a piece of software right now. You can hack your Apple TV, or you can put it on your Mac or PC, but it allows you to go to any type of website that has like Flash, like Hulu or any type of movie, and you can watch that stuff on your TV. Boxy now has a box by D-Link. It's this little teeny box. It could be under $200. You hook up, and so now you can watch all that content, like Noob. You can watch all that stuff, like surfing around with just a remote on your TV.
Oy
and
vey.
It's formatted. I'm sure you could even do porn if you want to do porn.
Oy vey.
But it was the menus were great. It was almost like a TiVo, and the videos came up instantly, so you could start watching Hulu. And it looked pretty, you know, Hulu looks pretty good for streaming.
Yeah, just to get Hulu alone would be great.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's
going to
be under $200,
TV.
And that's coming out in, I think, a couple months. Boxy TV. And then there was a bazillion things like that. I won't go on, but
okay.
There was a lot of that type of
stuff. Anything like that for you, Elise?
Yeah, actually something similar. I was going to talk about this thing called the Sony Dash. I don't think you even saw this.
No, I don't think so.
It is, I think they describe it as a personal internet viewer.
It's an iPad.
Hang
on. It's basically it
repeat
looks
that.
Like
a, it's a personal repeat.
Oh yeah, it's a personal internet viewer.
Personal internet viewer.
It's the coolest multitasking thing you've ever seen. Basically, it looks like your alarm clock. Like it's just or
oh,
actually, it looks
I
like a
saw
digital.
This.
Yeah, it looks like a digital picture frame or something like that. It sits by your on your bedstand, let's say.
Okay.
But it's like it can base it's hooked up to Wi-Fi 24/7 and you can customize it any way you want. There are 1,500 different apps. So basically, if you think about like your widgets on your desktop or anything like that, it can just live there. It'll give you the weather, the time, the traffic.
So it's
it
like
can
alarm
play video,
clock
it
that
can play
you
music.
Adjust to do what you want to do using
yeah.
apps.
Like if you want to see your stocks, the first thing you wake up in the morning, you want to look over and see it. Or some people would use it in the kitchen to display recipes step by step or things like that. Anyway, it's just an ultimately customizable thing that can run, you know, video, pictures, anything.
And actually, that was another big thing at CES, the like app or widget idea. I think this iPhone idea where you just buy little 99-cent things that install directly on the device. Those were in televisions. Those were in Blu-rays. They were all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah, because televisions are now hooked up to the internet, too. So
good.
They can display any information.
Like, I know they had a couple televisions that you just download the YouTube app. And then from your TV, you just watch. You can go straight to YouTube.
Great.
And it's formatted, so.
So that's Sony Dash. It's going to be available this year, and it's only $200.
This is interesting because... essentially, what you're saying is they're starting to use the model that they use with printers, where you buy the printer, but the printer is not where you make all your money necessarily. You can make it in other ways, and that's what they're paying attention to.
The ink that they don't know how to charge
for.
The
$1 million ink. I can't believe I was just at Costco. I can't
right.
believe how
well,
big
now
it's,
you know, now
the
it's
blood
apps.
Of infants does not come
well,
cheap.
The funny thing is we saw printers with app support.
Oh, really?
Everything has app support. I think the iPhone apps have just, you know...
Speaking of which...
Sorry?
Speaking of Canons and stuff, or the cameras and stuff, the Canon booth was freaking awesome. And they've got, I'm not going to talk about all the cameras there because you should just go to Canon because they have a
you
whole
mean Canon
series.
Brand.
Yeah.
Canon.
I got
Canon.
All excited about Canons.
No, no,
for
no.
A second. No.
No. But they
like
did
the
have
Canon
their,
7. Did they have the 7D there and stuff?
They had,
well, they had probably
everything.
Like, wow.
And they also have their new line of little mini HD cams, the Vixias. And there's like 3 or 4 different versions. Anyway, you should go online, check them out. They're amazingly small. They're 1080p. They look freaking amazing. We, you know, you could go there and shoot with it and stuff. I'm not sure how it is with low light or any of that stuff, but I would go and at least take a look at the website and see if you can get your hands
wow.
on one. But they're the size of small, like, Red Bull cans. They're teeny.
Jeez.
Yeah, they're pretty – it's pretty amazing. We saw Polaroid.
Oh,
there
yeah. Polaroid
with
was cool.
A real Polaroid camera. They're bringing it back. They're bringing back the film.
It's so it's, out. It's in again.
Exactly. And it, actually, the strange thing is there was a huge crowd around an old Polaroid. Like, they were bringing back the old model.
I could see that.
But they still have – they also were showing off their new digital camera that has a printer in it. So the
right.
whole concept of the updated Polaroid is there, too.
And they had a little $80 printer that was, like, the size of, like, a – I don't know, like a – small book or like an iPhone in a way. And you can plug it up to any digital camera and you could print little Polaroid type of photos from there.
From your digital camera. That's slick.
Quickly and instantly. I mean,
that's slick.
And you could pop in like a SD card and just print out, you know, little mini photos.
The ink cost $50,000.
Yes, exactly.
Actually, you're right. The paper was...
Well, it was what? Like $1 a pop or something? Yeah. We kept asking.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I just heard this story that the Society of International Weights and Measures, they were kind of ticked because printer cartridges don't have any standardization. They never say how much ink per cartridge or anything like that.
Oh, yeah.
So ink costs an indescribable amount. We don't know exactly how much ink costs, but it's incredibly expensive.
It's ridiculous.
Because they tell you by the page how much something costs, which is kind of ludicrous if you think about it.
Yeah, because...
what is a standard page?
What is a standard page? How many, you know, how many words are on a page?
Yeah, I'm a graphic designer. My pages are...
Could be anything.
They're all black.
Exactly.
You know,
it's ludicrous.
I looked everywhere for the red camera. And they didn't show up. They didn't have a booth there, but they did show up, and you should go check out the internet. They showed up with a mock Red Scarlet, their smaller camera.
Huh.
And you can go on Gizmodo, I believe, and they got some hands-on. So even though we didn't get to see it, you can look on the intertubes.
Awesome.
The last, I don't know, I want to talk about robots, but do you have anything else?
I got e-readers.
Oh,
I was
all right.
Obsessed.
E-readers are good before robots.
Yeah,
you're obsessed,
and I was like, wait until Apple.
Yeah, you can't.
I know, and now you're like, oh, maybe you should have been obsessed because those things look better. There was definitely advances made in the realm of the e-readers that were not in the iPad.
They were better than the iTampon.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that
okay.
was a bad
explain
name.
Explain how it was better.
Well, I mean, first of all, there are all these features that we've been waiting for, and that the Kindle still doesn't have, like a touch screen, or a lot of them had little pens, so you could, you know, write little notes, annotate your books yourself. But you know, the biggest difference between all these e-readers, every single one of them, and the iPad is that it's e-ink, you know, which people frown upon because it's not color yet. But it's for reading. It's exactly what you want. You want a reflective, something that reflects light to your eye. That's what's easiest on your eye rather than something that's backlit, that strains your eye.
I understand that, but how many hours a day are you on the computer? How's your eyes so
and
strained?
Your eyes go, turn, I go to
oh,
the bathroom,
please.
My eyes are bright
yeah,
red.
I'm
actually,
you, Aaron.
Yeah.
Yeah, I stare at text on that screen all day long. Yeah. I am not going to go home and read off another screen.
Man, I bet you your eyes were like far more open when you were 10 years younger, man, because yeah, you've just been
exactly
squinting at
keep
a screen.
Keep in mind, it's the Asian people in the room telling you how squinting to
exactly.
I've come on, man.
I have a third eyelid that comes down in emergency.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
She has a nictitating membrane.
I knew that, yes.
This is interesting. What you're saying is interesting, but it would seem to me like having an e-reader that can also be used to surf the internet and do all these other things.
Well, interesting you should say that, because let me introduce the Entourage Edge.
Oh, hi, Entourage Edge.
Hello. Which is, they call it a dual book, and essentially it's two screens. So you get the best of both worlds.
Really?
You get touchscreen e-ink on one side, and you get internet, you know, basically what I would consider a netbook on the other side. And you can link, like, words to web pages. You can sort of have the two sides interact in interesting
ways.
You can do that a little bit with the Kindle. I mean, I actually got a Kindle for Christmas, and I sent it back because it couldn't do what I wanted it to do.
Read scripts.
You know,
yeah, pretty much.
When you get, there's a whole slew coming out that can handle Word documents, like anything you can throw at it, they can display. They're really made for productivity as much as reading. So you'll see a lot more of that coming.
I wouldn't be so poo-poo on those e-books if they were under $100. I've always said the Kindle would be
cool
if it was $90.
I saw ones that were literally like, it looked like an iPhone. It was like tiny and thin, and they were super cheap. Like, they're just, there
That's
are many, many different
and
sizes
now, doesn't
coming.
The Kindle even look more ridiculous now that the Apple made an announcement? So for $100 more, you get a, you know.
Yeah. Well, they have to, you're right, they have to drop the price. I mean, the reason the Kindle was that high is they were the only game in town.
Yes.
Like, they were a monopoly.
It still, though, seemed absurd.
Well, if they were smart, though, they would have started dropping their price more dramatically.
Before they looked absurd.
Before other people came in to undercut them. You
right.
Know,
I mean, and they are dropping it, but, you know, they've got the Edge network packaged into it, or no, I'm sorry, like G3 packaged into it. So there are some things that help to balance out the expense of it, but
yeah, but there's no data being used.
You can access.
Yes, like you can. You can browse the internet.
You
badly,
can browse the internet on
badly,
Kindle.
Really
but it's,
badly.
But it's really bad.
Like not usefully.
Yeah.
But
so
you
like
can.
Well,
you can download your books on the fly though. Is the deal.
Yeah. Exactly.
So there's like 32K every month you're using. So don't
yes.
tell me that
right.
that they're spending any money on any 3G
network. No, but you know
network.
It's funny because when you look at all the new e-readers coming out, that is something that adds expense. If you get it Wi-Fi only, it's much cheaper than if you get
right.
one that has built-in network. But anyway, so all these cool features are coming. The one thing I was going to just say about the Edge, the reason I didn't like it is that it's big and heavy. Like having these two screens, it's like you might as well just have a laptop. It was just so big. Yeah. But the one that I loved the most was by Plastic Logic. It's called the Q. Did you see this?
The Cube?
The Q. Q-U-E.
Okay. Oh, wait. No, I did see that.
Yeah.
It's small, though.
Oh, no. This one is. It's
Wouldn't
literally
the
size of a page. It's,
oh, okay,
the screen size is 8.5 by 11. It has a nice frame around
it's Q-U-A-Y.
It.
Q-U-A-Y.
It's very thin.
Okay.
It's a touch screen.
Q-U-E.
Like you could read a newspaper on it beautifully. And that was probably my favorite of all of them. And that was the one that was geared way more towards productivity. And that was the one that it could handle, you know, any sort of
anything,
documents.
Anything
you want.
You
anything,
at it.
PDFs,
awesome.
Anything.
Fully touchscreen?
Yeah, it could interact with your, it had software for your PC that would help you, you know,
okay.
take cross.
Was it touchscreen?
It was touchscreen.
It was touchscreen, okay.
It was huge and beautiful and thin. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be out. Oh, and then they were partnered with Barnes & Noble, so they'll get all the Barnes & Noble's books.
That's the most important thing, is
yeah.
if any
yep.
of these things don't have a deal, then they're worthless.
And there were so many of these e-readers, I was wondering, like, they must be forming partnerships everywhere.
Yeah.
So that Q, it's expensive, though, the Q. If you get a 4-gigabyte one, it's $649. The 8-gigabyte that has 3G
they just
and
lost.
Wi-Fi. I know.
That's they just
crazy.
Lost.
But it's huge. It's huge and beautiful.
Well,
it's
lost.
It
doesn't matter. Too expensive.
Yeah, you're right. It is too expensive. But if they can get that price down in the near future, if this is one of those things where they bring it out, the early adopters grab it, and then they drop the price significantly, then that would still work.
Right.
And I don't understand, you know, like, so the 6 gig is $600 and the 8 gig is $800. I'm sorry, but I can go get a 2 gig stick
for
$50. Where is this money? Like, they're
don't,
trying to get
don't
the
get
price
me started
down by
on
how?
Memory because I had to fork over for the 120 gigabyte Xbox hard drive where they raped me.
So, trust me, I was the first one with my pants down on that.
Oh,
one.
Man. I just.
Yes,
over.
Yes, you were.
I've heard rumors that they're working on the same thing we're talking about here, but the screens are flexible.
Oh, yeah.
And that's another thing that may be coming down the line at some point.
I'm not sure if I need that, but. It is
but it's so cool. It's so sci-fi.
And then you could have a book.
one page book. You just
and you just
flip
it over
and over
again.
Well, I think the idea being that it's
going to make card tricks really silly.
I think the idea, though, is that it's more durable, you know,
yeah.
Yeah,
in theory.
Cool.
Because
my dog ate it. Doesn't matter.
The last
they
thing
need to come
I'd
out
like
with a waterproof
about
version.
The last thing I'd like to talk about is robots.
Oh, yeah. I see what you have there. I have pictures. Oh, yeah.
There's one thing that did make the internet, and that is this Parrot AR drone. This crazy little device is
this
a,
the one that is it's not an alternate reality. What is it called?
It's
augmented reality.
It does
yeah.
have augmented reality in it, but that's not, it kind of didn't work as well. But this drone has got, it's self-stabilizing. So like if you just like put the controller down and walk away, it just hovers in midair by itself. In fact, someone could even come over and whack it. We saw someone just, it flew toward me. Remember it on my
actually,
face?
Actually, I have that video and I don't know if there's any way you can link to it or if I can put it up
sure.
somewhere.
Yeah,
but
yeah, put it on YouTube.
You've got to see this video where the drone attacks Aaron.
Yeah. Almost hits me in the face and I go whack.
Which is what the drone is going to be used for ultimately. I think it's going to be an assassination robot. Discuss. I have to go.
Okay.
All right. Lisa's running out the door now. We're going to finish up CES without her.
Bye, Lisa.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
All right. Bye, Lisa.
So this drone is pretty damn cool. For one thing, it can be controlled by your iPhone.
Wow.
So
that's really
it's got
cool.
cameras in it, and it wirelessly broadcasts the image into your iPhone, and you tilt the iPhone around using the yeah, and it controls this damn thing. And that's where the augmented reality comes in, because it will then project a HUD onto the iPhone, and if it can actually see another one of the drones, and like when you it has like a fire button when you launch missiles, it puts virtual missiles in so you can see it hit. You'll make the drone kind of like sink and lower if you hit the other drone.
That's what I want to know.
Awesome.
is why this didn't exist when I was 15 years
old. Exactly.
And Joy Phillipson lived across the street from me. I'm just saying. Sorry, Joy.
We met Joy. I don't know how much this is going to be, but it's probably going to be kind of spendy.
Okay.
And there's lots of video online.
Many voyeurs suddenly got their favorite
and
toy.
And the last thing was, this is like this really inexpensive robot, RoboniI.com.
No, it's not. It's not Roboni.
Roboni.
Oh, God.
Is it Roboni? It is Roboni.
It sounds like something you get on pizza.
Come on. It sounds a lot worse
than
that.
But this actually kind of looked cool. You got this robot, which kind of looks like one of the tanks from Clone Wars in a way, with the circular wheels.
Gigantic circular wheels.
And you hooked it up to a PC, and you program the type of AI you want it to be, whether it was aggressive and how it made right turns.
Drinking
and all
blood.
This stuff. Yeah, that type of thing. And then you put it in you could play a game like a... it had these other little things you'd put on the ground, like base stations. And if it went and found the enemy's base station and fired something at it, it would score points. But the other cool thing is they had these rollovers with barcodes on it. And if any robots rolled over the barcodes, it would level up and get, like, you know, you could level
up
your
AI.
Guy. Yeah. Well, it would, like... You get bigger weapons, or you could get your shields up. And you weren't directly controlling the robot. It was all AI. And so you could put a whole bunch of them into a room, set up base stations of the enemy and yours, and then a whole bunch of, like, power-ups all over the room, and then program your robots.
I'm, like, hearing the Matchbox advertisement in my head.
It was
set it up with your friends.
Yeah, that's kind of, yeah. In fact, you can see this. It kind of even looks like the information. Anyway.
Except we have a crap-ass title. We've called it the Roboni.
Roboni-I.com, and you can go there and see how to program
it. I don't know why they named it that.
I don't.
That sounds like some sort of...
Because the Roboner just went completely. That was that one.
Yeah, the original one was the iBone. Didn't work.
iBone, no.
Anyway, that's kind of CES for me. I walked and walked and walked and walked and walked. It just went on and on. And, you know, after 3 days, I was, of course, done with it.
You were blind and done.
I love going there because the gadgets are just endless. I didn't even get to, like, the part where they have all these cars with all the car gadgets. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, and you could always go back in time and check Geeks on Twitter feed or Aaron's Twitter feed from about 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
and you can see all of the gadgets that he tweeted on the day.
Yes, I hope I gave everybody fair warning that I was going to be heavily twitting at that time, so you could detwit me if need be.
All right.
Anyway,
there it is.
Cool.
CES in a nutshell.
Bye. Have a good geek week.
Geek it out?
Geek it out.
Yeah, okay. I don't get that.